more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Since the mid-1970s, Old World Wisconsin has preserved and brought to life the state's rich ethnic heritage. As the largest outdoor museum of rural life in the country, Old World demonstrates how our immigrant ancestors lived through heirloom gardens, antique machinery, and painstakingly restored buildings. But a living history museum doesn't come together by itself, and perhaps we've taken for granted the history of the institution itself. Well, that's rectified in a new book by Marquette University professor John Krugler called Creating Old World Wisconsin. He tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce who came up with the idea for the museum.
Well, the man that's generally credited with is a Milwaukee architect by the name of Richard W. E. Perrin. And Mr. Perrin started going into the field in about 1928-29. And what he was very much interested in, besides his jobs in Milwaukee as an architect, he was very interested in vernacular or folk architecture. And his crusade was launched when he said, as he said at one point, he said, every year I went out into the field and more of these specimens disappeared. And so it was almost as if a blanket or a shroud had begun to cover the 19th century. And this was especially true after World War II when Americans began to move into the rural areas and these old houses had no attraction to them. So they were either torn down or they'd be remodeled and you wouldn't even be able to tell what the original fabric was. So Mr. Perrin in 1960 measured the Kepsel House in the town of Jackson near the Jackson Marsh in Washington County. He convinced the farmer to donate the building to the Historical Society. Now, in that same month, he approached the society, who had a new director, Dr. Leslie H. Fischel, who was the seventh director of the society. And Fischel probably would have been well advised to simply say, "Well, Mr. Perrin, this is wonderful, but we just don't have the resources." But Perrin was persistent, and in 1964, he went before the board of curators and made a very convincing argument that they needed to endorse this idea of capturing, saving, preserving, rescuing, salvaging, however you want to describe it, and bringing them to a common site. So that's what I would say would be the origins of it. One man who had worked with other architects and saw the need for state intervention in terms of preservation.
Now, had the society ever taken on a project like this before?
Traditionally, this Wisconsin Historical Society was nationally known for its archives and library, and it had a wonderful archival collection, and that's where they spent most of their time and energy, that and the books. The state's historical library was the library, the American History Library for the University of Wisconsin, so you can see it was a very, very massive and important undertaking. There were many who worried that if the society got into historic sites, it was going to be a disaster from a budgetary standpoint because I won't say they lived a hand-to-mouth existence, but it was close to that. They were pretty much at subsistence level. Beginning in late 1940s, the society began to think about we have to have more to our mission than just serving scholars. We need to get into what was derisively called popular history. And popular history was most generally effective by using historic sites. So by 1953, the society had acquired three sites. They were existing sites. The DNR owned them. And so the society began to manage them and administer the sites. But no, they had never tried to create a museum from scratch. And so this became an incredible challenge because, A, they didn't have enough money to do it. B, they had no experience. There were no manuals. There were no how do you build a museum booklets out there for them. So they simply went into it kind of on a wing and a prayer.
What were the options before them? They had this capsule building that was donated to them by Mr. Perrin. What then were the options before them in terms of what they could do with this
well,
building?
Well, the most important thing and the one that took the most time was acquiring the site. Now, they had looked at Bong Air Base, which was going to be released by the United States government, but that didn't happen until the mid-70s, so that really wouldn't have been an effective choice. Their eye kind of was set on that wonderful state forest, the Southern Kettle Moraine Forest at Eagle, and that was where most of their planning went. Now, this was a great situation because much of the forest they wanted was owned by the Department of Natural Resources, a state agency. The society was a state agency, so, gee— it should be very easy to affect this, but because of state law and because of reluctance on the part of the DNR, they could not affect this lease until 1971. So it was 10 years that the struggle to get the site went on. So that was probably the biggest consideration. It took an awful lot of time. But I think in terms of your question, the capsule house, I said it was donated. I didn't say it was taken to any place by the society. In 1969, the society said, you know, we better go out there and see what's happened with the capsule house. And so they sent Jack Wynn out there, and he was able to reestablish a relationship with the family and eventually got the building to be donated. What I'm suggesting here is that this was a long and in many ways a very torturous process, in large part fueled by the fact the society really didn't have enough money to be doing this. And so it was kind of a hand-to-mouth existence for them to get the museum started. The crew scoured the state, and they began to find buildings they wanted in Polk County, Dane County, Dodge County, Rock County. So they were all over the state looking for buildings.
You talked about the lack of funding, but I wonder that example of what happened with the capsule house seems to be a perfect example of the lack of experience going into this. What maybe could have been done differently had there been someone who really knew how to bring these buildings to this site properly?
Let me start by quoting my favorite 19th century humorist, Mark Twain, who said, "The lack of money is the root of all evil." So most of the problems that the society encountered was due to the fact that they simply didn't have enough money to be able to do what they wanted to do. The people that supported it were very enthusiastic, and they really, really were pushing very hard. In terms of what they could have done differently, I think if they'd have done anything differently, the museum would not have happened. There's almost a genius in the way they did this. And Les Fischel, when I interviewed him, said that, you know, his approach was to do it incrementally, one step at a time. I had seen that in the records, but I hadn't recognized it. And so after he said that, then I realized, wow, you know, this is just exactly what they were doing. So they went after the site. That got to be a long and drawn-out, protracted struggle. The most interesting thing about what could they have done differently, the obvious choice would have been to go to a professional planner. You know what? That costs a lot of money. So the question became, how can we get a master plan virtually for free? Fischel called the head of the landscape architecture department. He said, we have this project that we're thinking about doing, and I need somebody who might be able to put together a master plan. And the head of the department says, well, we just hired this new young guy from Harvard. He's been here about a year now, but he really loves old buildings. Well, loving old buildings and building a museum plan are two different things. This is one of the things that got me into writing this book, is because I interviewed Bill Tischler in 1993 and 1994. I was working on a different project at the time, and I was so fascinated by his story. As a college professor, you know, you kind of know how far you can push your students, and I try to push them to the nth degree. But Bill started with a design studio class in second semester of 1966-67, and he had 16 undergraduate students, 15 men and one woman. And that class put together four preliminary plans for the museum, and they made a presentation to the faculty of the landscape architecture department in June of 1967. That was enthusiastically endorsed, and then they went on to meet with the curators and sold the plans to them, and they, again, enthusiastically endorsed the plans.
Well, once they had the site established by 1971, I believe you said.
Well, the site was transferred, and then they began working on the site in 72.
It was a short amount of time to 1976 when the site actually opened. That's a lot to have happened in a five-year period. Talk about the dominoes that fell to get this museum together.
Well, first of all, let me start with Alan Pape, who was the construction supervisor. He went to his supervisor and said, you know, we need a lot of people to be re-erecting these buildings. And his supervisor said, hire cheap, you know. And so Alan, at least for the first couple of summers, relied on local high schoolers to do the work. Anything, and Mr. Perrin endorses, if the public couldn't see it, then you can do anything you want. Now, I mean, you know, that's not exactly the kind of workmanship you'd like. You'd like somebody who's maybe got 20 years in on reconstructions, restorations. So they had to rely on very inexperienced workers. So that was a complicating problem. It meant that Alan would have to be there supervising frequently. But Alan also was in the field. Why was he in the field? He was looking for buildings. And the number of trips that gone up to Bayfield County and found some wonderful specimens that are in the museum from from the Finnish. And they also found Ed Puttus, who was a Finn, who was a carpenter. And so they co-opted him and brought him down. And so he was more or less the supervisor for the construction of the Finnish buildings that they had brought back. In addition to trying to find the buildings, which was very exhausting, and Alan was, a number of people have told me, he told me himself, no brag, just fact, he could see a 19th century building where others couldn't. But from 1973, when the first construction started in June, until June 30th, 1976, 3 years to get the museum built.
So what was opening day like?
The people that were responsible for planning, they thought maybe 2,000, but we, you know, planned for 5,000. They had accepted estimate was between 8,000 and 12,000 people to Eagle. Now, they probably should have been able to figure it out that this was going to be a big attraction, A, for the publicity, but, you know, Wisconsins love anything that's free. And so these Wisconsinites came in great numbers. They literally flooded the site. There were so many problems on site, it's mind-boggling. The Ramsey Barn was going to be the visitor center. It wasn't ready. There was no water on site because the well digger took off a couple weeks before the site opened. St. Peter's Church, the painters went on strike, so they didn't have the painting completed. They received their slideshow the morning of the opening, and they had no place to show it. So, you know, they thought, well, we'll use the basement of St. Peter's Church, which was now nearing completion. The problem there was they had no electricity. So what they did is they brought a generator. Generators make big noise. And so you have these people filing down into the basement of St. Peter's to see the slideshow with a, you know, an audio and can't hear it.
How did then Old World Wisconsin survive this day when everything that could go wrong went wrong? I mean, what went right? Something obviously went right because Old World Wisconsin survived after this and today is thriving.
What went right about this? Well, a lot of things went right. By the time the second season opens in 1977, they've already made great strides. It was a tease in 1976, a kind of showing you this is what we might be able to become. I think they had, the numbers are 67 re-erected buildings, historic buildings. It wasn't what they planned, but it was much more than the state deserved out of, you know, what the resources were.
Well, John Krugler, thank you so much for coming in and telling us the story of creating Old World Wisconsin.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
John Krugler is a professor of early American history and public history at Marquette University. His latest book is Creating Old World Wisconsin, The Struggle to Build an Outdoor History Museum of Ethnic Architecture. There's a link to more information about it at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then a fictional Old World Wisconsin curator travels to Iowa and finds the dark side of Norwegian culture, murder. Lake Effect returns right after this. You're listening to us on Milwaukee Public Radio.